This is a CBC podcast. From the smallest subatomic particles to the largest objects in the sky, Quirks and Quarks is there. Every week, host Bob McDonald presents the people behind the latest discoveries in the physical and natural sciences. Go to cbc.ca/quirks for podcasts, downloads, and more.
From the Rebecca Colon Auditorium in Halifax, Nova Scotia, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it's good to be back in Nova Scotia, and it's especially good to be here in Halifax. This province, this city, is a sort of second home to this show. Nova Scotia, you know, is where Dave hails from. So I've thought a lot about what I should say here on the show, now I mean, to start, because, well, as you know, it is my habit to say something at the beginning. When I thought of all the things that I could say about being here, what I decided what I'd like to do is this. I'd like to take a few moments to say a few words about Ruth Goldbloom. And I thought you might feel like that. And I thought those of you who are listening at home who do not live here and might not know Ruth, who might be wondering who she might be, thought you might be interested in hearing about her too. So where to begin? How to describe Ruth Goldbloom? Shall I start at the beginning, which is never a bad idea? Or should I start at the end? When she died this summer, the plan was to hold Ruth's funeral at Pier 21, Canada's National Museum of Immigration, a museum that she pretty much single-handedly willed into existence. It was her wish to hold her funeral there, but they had to move it next door to the Kennard Center because the museum wasn't big enough. Over 2,500 people showed up. It was, by all accounts, the biggest and most joyful funeral in Halifax's history. That would be the end, I guess. Though anyone who knew Ruth well, which would be every second person here in Halifax, anyone who knew her well would be hard-pressed to say that her death marked the end of her. The beginning? Well, if you're going to start at the beginning, we would start on the 5th of December in 1923, in New Waterford, Nova Scotia. New Waterford was a grimy coal mining town in 1923, and that was the year Ruth was born. Kind of place where the main street was paved on one side and still dirt on the other. And the dirt side was the smoother ride. Ruth's family came from Russia. Jewish family who came to Nova Scotia, to New Waterford, of all places, looking for what every immigrant family's looking for a better life. They were in the rag trade, Schwartz's clothing store. And when I say they, Ruth's father died when he was 35, so Ruth was raised by her mother. Her widowed mother ran the store, and running a clothing store in New Waterford meant, well, it meant the phone might ring anytime, might ring at midnight. Dearie, could you open the store? Isabel passed. Because, of course, you would want to get poor old Isabel into a new dress as soon as you could, so she could be laid out fine in the living room first thing in the morning. Ruth's mom, Rose Schwartz, knew everyone in town, knew their size and what they liked. Oh, Isabel looked lovely in blue. But how much is that dress, Mrs. Schwartz? Why, it's only $21.95. Well, Mrs. Schwartz, that's a lot of money. Yes, it is. but that's a washable dress. Ruth was born into sales, but she trained as a tap dancer. She was something of a protege, although how much competition could there have been in New Waterford in 1920? Mother used to put her on the Sydney bus for her weekly lesson. And pretty soon she was dancing at every fundraiser between New Waterford and Sydney. One of the family's treasured childhood possessions, a family heirloom of sorts, is a card advertising one benefit. Friday night, it reads, Ruth Schwartz will tap dance. Police protection provided. She went away to college, supposedly to Queens, but she got off the train in Montreal instead and talked her way into McGill University. Pretty soon, she was bringing her boyfriend, a young medical student named Richard Goldblum, back to New Waterford for the summer. It's a great place for a young man who wanted to be a doctor to spend his summers. They hired him at the 50-bed Wood Frame Hospital, and before he knew it, Richard, the summer student, was delivering babies and suturing wounds and performing appendectomies. If they had any idea what I did down there, said Richard when I had lunch with him earlier this week, they would have thrown me in jail. There were only four doctors in town, and they still attended, well, home births, for instance. The stories are legendary. The mother in the late stages of labor, her six or eight kids gathered around watching the action, watching to see if they were getting a brother or a sister. And when the answer was delivered, the littlest one looking up at the doctor, Doc, said the boy, how'd that baby get in my mother's stomach? Well, said the doctor, your father planted a seed there. Boy thinks that over, and then he shoots the doctor a disparaging look. Don't give me that guff, doctor. My father's too lazy to mow the lawn. Richard told me that one. And how Ruth was the love of his life. Ruth, who loved to laugh and tap dance. She'd still do it at the drop of a hat when she was in her late 80s, up on the table at every second Halifax fundraiser. It is hard to describe her energy and humor, said Bob Ray when I asked him. And then he paused and he said, she was, you know, one of the greatest people I have come to know. Thoughtful and public-spirited, energetic and enthusiastic, Ruth and Richard moved to Halifax in 1967, where Ruth soon became the first woman chair of the Halifax United Way, the fundraising chair for the Children's Hospital, fundraising chair for Mount St. Vincent University, a woman's Catholic university. I've never heard of Mount St. Vincent's, wrote J.W. McConnell of the Montreal McConnell Foundation when Ruth wrote to him and asked for a donation. But if they hired a nice Jewish girl to fundraise for them, they can't be all that bad. Everyone will give you a list of things that Ruth accomplished here in Halifax, the hospitals, the university, the United Way, the symphony, and of course, the creation of the National Museum of Immigration at the old Pier 21, Canada's Ellis Island. The place where immigrants arrived in Canada, if they arrived by sea between the 1920s and the 1970s, the disembarkation point. From there, well, from here, they got on trains and dispersed across the country. The idea of taking that old terminal that was Pier 21 and turning it into a National Museum of Immigration wasn't Ruth's, but without Ruth, wouldn't have happened. Ruth understood pretty much before anyone else that Pier 21 was an important place to preserve, that it would become a Canadian touchstone. She was, for over a decade, the heart and the soul of the movement to preserve it. And she remained the heart and soul of it once it opened, having fundraised it into existence, having cajoled businessmen and businesswomen and more than one prime minister to pony up what they could pony up. Ruth decided if the museum was going to continue, there should be a $7 million endowment fund. Someone decided they'd try to recruit seven people and get them to donate $1 million each. A lot of people were skeptical about that. But Ruth believed it was possible. Ruth believed anything was possible. She had this way of persuading people to do things. Here's a story. When her three children were young, before they moved to Halifax, when she and Richard were living in Montreal, a young boy from the neighborhood knocked on their door one day and asked if they'd like him to deliver the Montreal Gazette every morning. Ruth thought that would be nice. She agreed to a subscription to the morning paper, as long as the boy didn't leave it on the front stoop. She wanted him to bring it into the house and then upstairs into her bedroom. And he did, for over 2 years. And when there was a family reunion this autumn, someone convinced the now owners of that old house to allow the extended family to return for a tour. And when they arrived, there was the paper boy, an adult now, waiting by the door, gazette in hand. The point is, Ruth could get people to do things they would never dream of doing, just by asking. She never forced anyone to say yes. She gave them the opportunity to move outside of the margins. She allowed them to be their best selves. And in doing so, she enriched their lives. She had a special relationship with everybody. And so today, here I am in Halifax, and I would like to say this. Here's to Ruth Goldblum. She represented the best of us. She was fiercely Canadian and fierce in her need to contribute. And she was fiercely kind and fiercely funny. She believed anything was possible, and she went out and proved that was so. She was the daughter of a poor immigrant family who gave more back than she ever received. She was joyful. A tap dancer who refused to see the bad in people. She was intolerant of bad table manners and little else. She stuck her nose in other people's business. And if she could, she told them how to do their business better. And now she's gone. And it would do us all good from time to time to wonder what Ruth Goldblum would have to say about our table manners, or anything really. The way we talk to one another. The way we are tap dancing through the days. She was one of a kind. We are better that she was among us. We are diminished by her passing. Now it's time to get to the music part of the show now. And I am so excited to introduce today's musical guest. The East Coast of Canada has a diverse and fertile musical landscape. Music scene here in Halifax and in this part of the country has done much to enrich the Canadian music scene. It means something when I say that this guy's not only my favorite East Coast musician, he's one of my favorite musicians, period. I like the way he sings. I like the way he writes. I like the way he writes about this city. Ladies and gentlemen, the very wonderful Joel Plaska.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you. So I start with a love song. Listen up, kids. It's not what you think. Stayed out too late. Had a little too much to drink. Walked home across the bridge when the marquee shut down. There's a reason that I love this town. I hear rumors of a reopening soon. Nobody cares how much money you have. If you've got enough to get in a cab, there'll be drinks on the house if your house burns down. There's a reason that I love this town. I saw your band in the early days. We all understand why you moved away, but we'll hold a grudge anyway. Live radio. I shot the script with miniature Tim. If he needs a hit, I could write one for him. We like the same books and we like the same sounds. There's a reason that I love this town. But no, they can't all be the same. So if they treat you wrong, take the nightly opportunity to pay them back in song. I played a show in Kelowna last year. They said, pick it up, Joel. We're dying in here. Picture one hand clapping, now picture half that sound. There's a reason why I hate that town. You saw my band in the early days. Then you will understand why we moved away. Actually, we decided we would stay. But you held a grudge anyway. Because it's fun. That's why I hold my grudges. Mostly for entertainment purposes. There's still a few that kind of are lingering and slightly bitter, but most of them, even the one against Kelowna, has faded with time. But I did have a rough show there, but that's all in the past, you know? And this song is controversial. My wife was born in Kelowna, ladies and gentlemen. So I have in-laws there. They've got free copies of my record, which they've since burned. But so we stumble. We get back, we treat every show like it's the last night of the tour. Davey and me, face down in our soup, in some French restaurant, outside Rivière du Loup. And I know Dave's out there, so this is for you. The last night of the tour, and we rocked that joint to the ground. And then we sang it together in Halifax, Nova Scotia. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town. That or why, whichever works for you. There's a reason why I love this town. One last time. There's a reason I love this town. Yes!
Good, everyone. Songs off Joel's wonderful album, La-Di-Da. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. You know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, they have to be short stories, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. promise we'll read everything you send us, and we promise we'll read some of our favorites right here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we promise we'll send you a copy of our latest Vinyl Cafe book. It's called Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. Today's story comes to us from Ray Russo of Aylesford, Nova Scotia. Dear Stuart, writes Ray, I live in the beautiful Annapolis Valley. Living in the country's great. We only have a few neighbors, but the neighbors we do have all chip in to help each other out. The story's about two of those neighbors, Roger and France, and their Pomeranian dog, Stormy. Stormy had many wonderful years with his family, but he was getting old. He had lost his vision, his hearing, and sadly, most of his hair. France wasn't ready to say goodbye to her dog. France's husband, Roger, on the other hand, felt it was time to put the pup out of his misery. Every time Roger and his wife went on vacation, Roger would secretly hope that the dog would pass. One day, I was in Roger's garage, and we were talking about the dog. Easter was approaching, and Roger and France were going away for the long weekend. I asked him then if he'd like me to have Stormy put down while they were away. Roger loved the idea. He knew it was time to put Stormy out of his misery. He knew France felt the same way. He also knew she didn't have the heart to make the decision. Roger and France left Thursday at noon. I told my wife I was heading over to their house to take Stormy out for a pee. When I got there, I grabbed the dog and headed for the vet. I showed up without an appointment. And when I did, I explained that I needed to put my dog down. They asked me a number of questions that I thankfully knew the answers to. And then they did an examination that confirmed Stormy should be put down. We moved into the procedure room. When it was all done, I took a deep breath and went back to the front to pay the bill. Gave them my name and address and money, and pretty soon I was out the door with a dead dog in my arms. I drove back and placed the dog in his bed in his family's home, and then I returned to my place for supper with my family. After dinner, I told my wife that I was going over to Roger's to let Stormy out. I came back to our house and announced to my wife that the dog was gone. Must have passed away peacefully in his sleep, I said, just as France was hoping for. I called Roger the next morning to announce the death of his dog and told him that I would bury Stormy. I went outside, shovel and small wooden cross in hand, and I closed this chapter in our lives. Or so I thought. The next week, my wife received a sympathy card in the mail from the vet's office. It was signed by all the staff. We are so sorry about the loss of your dog, Stormy. Wondering how they knew of Stormy's death, my wife called the vet's office. They told her the dog had been put down at my request. To this day, my wife will not allow me to look after our friend's animals. Luckily, she was able to keep the secret from France. France and Roger now live on the West Coast, and to my knowledge, France has never learned the full truth. Hopefully, she doesn't listen to the Vinyl Cafe. Story came to us from Ray Russo of Aylesford, Nova Scotia. Here's Joel Plaska.
Here's a song I wrote to sing outside in the summertime, but indoors in the winter works for me. On this earth, we get weary, we get hurt. What we need is not for sale. So set your heart down on the rail. Leaving's just another way to say the things we never say. Walking in the autumn leaves, let's get lost in record sleeves. Sun goes down upon the bay, looking for somewhere to play. I came here to bring the noise to the island girls and the harbor boys, to the island girls and the harbor boys. Racing to the finish line, we've been running, we've been flying. Faster as the years roll by, clouds are scrolling across our sky. If we get hailed by higher powers, it's only in the final hours. After that, we'll get some rest, but until then, let's make a mess. Sun goes down upon the bay, looking for somewhere to play. I came here to bring the noise to the island girls and the harbor boys, to the island girls and the harbor boys. Lie, lie, la 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 lie. Let me rage against the dying light before the by and by. I stand beneath a devastating sky above me, high above. I lose myself in everything I love before the night is through. My friends, I sing it now for you. Sun goes down upon the bay, looking for some to play. I came here to bring the noise to the island girls and the harbor boys, to the island girls and the harbor boys. Lie, la, lie, la, 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 lie, lie. Stay put, Halifax. Can I go nowhere with you? Hey, good looking. Why the frown? You always look better when it's upside, and you say you got nowhere that you're going to. Can I go nowhere with you? I took the Dartmouth ferry into the town. Spend my pennies bumming around, trying to find a way to tear a strip off these blues. Can I go nowhere with you? Paid the cover, saw the show, sat at the bar where the drinks did flow. Didn't see a single face that I knew till I went nowhere with you. Can I tag along tonight? We'll kill some time. It looks like you might need a little company. I'm so cheap, I might as well be free. Hey, good looking, why the frown? You always look better when it's upside and you say you got nowhere you going to. Can I go nowhere with you? And then we go. Can I go nowhere with you? Sing with me, go by yourself. Make it sound more Scottish, Halifax. Can I go nowhere with you? Can I tag along tonight? We'll kill some time. It looks like you might need a little company. I'm so cheap, I might as well be free. Whoa, 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 if you get tired and want to go home with me, I'm still wired, I'ma go it alone. The same time next week at 10:15, and we can go nowhere again. Show up then you know I will too. Can I go nowhere with you? Hey, good looking, why the frown? You always look better when it's upside down. You say you got nowhere you're going to. Can I go nowhere with you? Let's go again. Na, 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 na. Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? You got nowhere that you're going to. Can I go nowhere with you? Sure you can. Can I go nowhere with you? Let me be your man. Can I go nowhere with you? I hope you understand. Can I go nowhere with you?
Joel Plaska. I love that song. He'll be back. Dave, standing in front of his house, and he's holding two canvas bags. His shoulders are drooping, and the bags are kind of hanging by his knees. He could be on a stage. He could be playing Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. Those are groceries in the bags. And Dave is standing there on the sidewalk on this chilly winter afternoon, just home from work in the grocery store, looking as defeated as Willie Loman. And this is what he's thinking. He's thinking about something he read about or heard about, or maybe he saw it on TV, can't remember. But the gist of it is that there were some pre-industrialized people who were clearly wiser in the ways of the world than we are today, or the ways of illness, anyhow. He can't remember when or where these people lived. Maybe it was medieval Europe. Maybe it was sub-Saharan Africa, or perhaps pre-contact America. Quite frankly, it doesn't matter. The point is, these people who may or may not have lived in a medieval hamlet or a tropical jungle did this thing when someone got sick. I mean, really sick. We're not talking about the common cold here. We're not talking about trivial things like rhinoviruses. They had no idea what they did if someone got a rhinovirus. People he was thinking of were not doing battle with the common cold. They were tackling one of those terrifying, contagious illnesses like the plague or tuberculosis or hemorrhagic fever. One of those diseases where it all goes fine at first. Well, not fine. You feel a bit achy, and then a general malaise settles on you, and when you check, you find you're running a fever, like everyone in Dave's house, for instance. And then right out of the blue, you start to fall apart for no apparent reason. You're covered in boils, or you start sprouting bruises, and before you know it, you're on death's door. And the initial symptoms are exactly the same as the flu. If you have one, for all you know, you could be one cough away from developing the other. Now, probably, more than likely, okay, almost certainly, no one inside Dave's house, the house he's standing in front of, looking like Willie Loman, probably, almost certainly, no one in that house has the Black Plague or consumption or the horrifying Ebola virus. And no one was going to cough themselves into the grave or bleed out or expire in any way, but we're getting to the nub of the matter now. If they did have one of those things, and any cautious person had to acknowledge that there was at least a possibility of that, and if they did, it was possible that they could give him what they had. Probably not. But scientifically speaking, taking emotion out of it, you couldn't say that for sure, could you? For example, fruit bats are the most likely reservoir for Ebola fever. You can read about that on the net. Dave did. So let's start with this indisputable fact. There was plenty of fruit in the house. For that matter, there was plenty of fruit in the bags by his feet. With the thought of that, Dave looked around furtively, just checking. Didn't believe he was going to be attacked by a fruit bat in the middle of the winter in the middle of his neighborhood. I mean, it was unlikely. But you didn't have to be, what were Morley's exact words? What did she say? A hysterical lunatic. You didn't have to be a hysterical lunatic to imagine a scenario where bat-induced fever was, if not probable, at least possible. Imagine this. Imagine a bin of bananas sitting on some tropical dock somewhere at the edge of some swampy, bat-ridden banana plantation. And imagine one of those disease-ridden, gigantic fruit bats, some cloaked, winged thing the size of a dog. And it just landed on the bananas, smacking its greedy vampire lips. And some of that bat saliva just dropped onto the banana peel, like the very bananas that were ripening in the blue bowl on his kitchen cabinet. It was possible. Couldn't deny that. And if someone, say, his son, picked up that banana and then didn't wash his hands properly after he peeled it, say he peeled it, and then he touched his face without washing, which wasn't so unlikely. It's not at all impossible. In fact, that part was probable. Okay. He shouldn't have wondered about that out loud. Or he should have dropped it. But he felt it was important, so they would be more careful about washing their hands. That was all, as he kept trying to explain. And he would have let it go if she could have just acknowledged the terrifying fact that the degree of separation between their house and an Ebola-ridden fruit bat was one lousy banana. And let's not forget, Sam was the first to get sick. Anyway, back to those pre-industrial people and that pre-modern medical time. If someone from that community got sick, like Sam and Morley had, for instance, not with a cold, but lying in bed the way they were, listless and feverish and cranky, if that happened, what the townsfolk did was bring food to the sick person's hut or cottage or shelter, whatever it was they lived in, and left the food outside the door. Like room service. That's how Dave put it. It was just like room service. And then the villagers watched the basket of food to see if it disappeared from the doorway. But from a distance, they watched from a distance. The point was, no one went in the sick hut. No one served the food. And if the food wasn't touched, if the sick person didn't come out of the hut and get the food themselves, then after a set period of time, Dave couldn't remember the exact number of days, but after the certain number of days or weeks, if no one retrieved the food, the villagers burned the hut. Assuming that the person inside was lost. You had to admit there was wisdom in that. morally didn't see it that way. Though maybe if Dave hadn't been wearing a scarf around his face and rubber gloves when he explained it, maybe she wouldn't have been so upset. Come to think of it, she seemed to be as upset about the scarf and the gloves as anything. Anyway, as he tried to explain, if you burn the hut and the people who were in it, who would clearly be dead anyway, you stop the plague or the Ebola or whatever it is in its tracks and no one else dies, you save everyone else in the house. I mean the village, he said. Through the scarf. From the hallway. Maybe if he had brought the supper tray into the room instead of setting it down in the hall and standing there by the doorway in his scarf and gloves, she wouldn't have been so emotional. Anyway, it was just, the point is that everybody was sick in Dave's house. In fact, everyone he knew seemed to be sick, and the whole city seemed to be sick, and he was the outlier. He was the one person standing between the flu and its near perfect record of infection. And for over a week, Dave had been waging a constant war to keep it that way. And he was getting neither sympathy nor understanding from his sick wife. Which wasn't making his battle any easier. Just a moment ago, walking up the street, that lady with the little dog walking towards him, she had been no more than, what, 10 feet away when she sneezed? 10 feet. Barely enough time for Dave to change his breathing pattern with a quick inhalation so he was on the exhale as he walked by her. Couldn't let your guard down for a moment, not for a moment. It was exhausting. And in the middle of it all, he had to open his store every day. And of course, you inevitably mess up. Not necessarily touching people, but you touch their things. And he'd try to wash his hands whenever it happened, but you slip up. Like the other afternoon, Terrence, the mailman, he needed Dave to sign for, I forget what it was, a registered letter or something, and then the phone rang. Right after Dave signed for the letter, but before he had a chance to rinse his hands, it was the phone that distracted him. And it was Morley. And it was while he was talking to her that Terrence left, and before Dave knew it, he was holding the phone with one hand and he was trying to dig something out of his eye with the other, which was the same hand he had used to hold Terrence's pen. He decided the best thing to do would be to flush his eyes. Unfortunately, the only antiseptic he could find was a bottle of mouthwash. If you hadn't phoned, he said to Morley from the emergency department, where he was having his eyes irrigated, this wouldn't have happened. You phoned at exactly the wrong moment. And on he soldiered. For an entire week, cooking and cleaning, worrying and wondering. A little collection of remedies under the counter at work, bottle of zinc, some vitamin C, echinacea and elderberry extract. He knew most of them had been shown to be of marginal, if no benefit. But you could never be sure. He dosed himself according to the instructions on the bottles. Well, okay, slightly more than the instructions. At least he was doing something. It snowed on the Friday. Not the storm of the century, but hard enough to get the Weather Channel's attention. Enough snow that there weren't a lot of people out and about. And by the end of the day, enough snow had fallen that rush hour was a mess. Dave closed his record store early, stopped at the grocery store on the way home. And then when he got home, he stood in front of his house, the grocery bags hanging by his knees, looking as morose as Willie Loman. After he stood there for a moment, he carried the bags onto the porch and set them down by the door, and he shoveled the walk. He was about to go in and fix supper when he saw an upstairs light snap off at the Turlingtons. Both Mary and Bert were as sick as Morley, maybe worse. And so he sighed, and he took a shovel, and he shoveled the Turlingtons' walk, too, and their drive. And when he had finished that, he did Jim Schofield's. Jim has a corner house. So it was like doing two houses. Actually, more like doing four. The walk, the driveway, and the sidewalk all around. So Dave was cold and wet and exhausted when he finally went inside. Sam was on the couch in his pajamas watching Brady Bunch reruns. It's the Tattletale episode, said Sam. Season 2, episode 10, said Dave, that little rat Cindy. Morley was still upstairs, still in bed. Dave made soup for Morley. Sam, who seemed to be rallying, asked for spaghetti. Phone rang. It was Jim. Thanks for doing the walk, said Jim. And then he said, do you mind? There's one more thing. And so Dave put his coat back on and he trudged out. Jim needed something from the drugstore. I'm having a James Bond festival, said Jim when Dave delivered his meds. I'm on number 7. Diamonds Are Forever, 1971, said Dave. Connery's last. Second to last, said Jim. Dave threw Jim the little bag of medicine. Didn't want to get too close. He was trying to keep his breathing shallow. He was being careful. He was also exhausted, starving. When he got home, he finished the rest of Sam's spaghetti right out of the pot. Then he went upstairs to see if Morley needed anything. She was lying on her bed, surrounded by magazines, Real Simple, The Walrus, a pile of New Yorkers. And that moment, right then, staring at his wife, surrounded by magazines, that moment is when it occurred to Dave that everyone else's life seemed a lot better than his. Everyone with a flu, that is. Sometimes when you try to walk to the beat of a different drummer, sometimes when you are the only soldier in step, you end up getting stepped on. Sometimes the rhythm of the many is the best rhythm of all, no matter what drum the many are marching to. He had lasted so long. He had fought so valiantly. He'd been so careful, it was hard to believe he succumbed so fast. But he did. Came over him on Monday morning, suddenly and seemingly out of the blue, a terrible case of the flu, absolutely miserable. Luckily, without the aches or fever, or sniffles, or anything really that was plaguing everyone else, though he shared many of their other symptoms. For instance, he found himself unable to get out of bed, or cook, or take out the garbage. And the thought of shoveling snow made him feel positively ill, as did the idea of unloading the dishwasher. Luckily, the day before he was so surprisingly laid low, he stocked up on bagels and chips and a stack of movies he'd been meaning to watch. Exactly 2 days worth. And coincidentally, 2 days was precisely the number of days it took for the flu to move through him. When he did emerge, he did look surprisingly rested and rosy. No doubt a result of his carefully cared for and highly tuned immune system. And the 2 days in bed. And the bagels, of course. Someone should do a study on Montreal bagels. I'm not saying that's what saved him. I'm just saying he seemed to bounce back a lot faster than anyone else. Thank you. Thank you very much. Sadly, we've come to that part of the show where it's time to say goodbye. And before we do, I want to thank our special musical guest, Joel Plaska. Thanks also to everyone here at the Colin, Colin, Ian, and MJ for making our visit so fun and easy. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Bill Herault and Greg DeClute are the recording engineers. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We're going to let Joel Plaskett sing us out now. So long, until next time.
Oh, side of the road in the ditch of rust. A mouth full of mud from a fistful of dust. A heart full of hurt from a head full of wine. I'll call you back some other time. There's no way I'm picking up my phone. I'm tired of talking, leave me alone. I can't run and I can't write. No, and I can't make it home tonight. No, no. Rolling, rolling, rolling. Gathering no moss. I don't know where I'm going, but I know what I've lost. Talk is cheap, but music's cheaper. Deep in debt and I'm getting deeper. Price is steep and getting steeper. I'm yours to keep, oh, won't you keep me? I'm a keeper. Rolling, rolling, rolling. I'm gathering no moss. I do not know where I'm going, but I know what it costs. Pretty people posing questions. I don't. Where'd you go? Did you learn your lesson? I put on my dancing shoes. Who'd you meet and what you buy? A couple strangers, a pair of jeans. Just leave them hanging high and dry. Bye-bye. Rolling, rolling, rolling. With my imaginary friends. Imagining I know them. But then it's time to roll again off. Oh. And I'll roll across the bridge back home to Darwin. Why so blue, tired and true? I'm tired of myself, not tired of you. They say that good things come to those who roll back to someone beautiful. Woo! I'm gathering no moss. I do not know where I'm going yet. No, but I know what I've lost. Rolling, rolling, rolling. It's time to get me gone. The yellow lines are glowing. Oh, how we're roaming home.
Hello, you've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Over the next few months, Stuart McLean will be doing live concerts in Clinton Township, Michigan, Bay City, Michigan, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, Windsor, Almont, Milton and Burlington, Ontario, St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and Danceland in Manitou Beach, Saskatchewan. Check the website for all the details, vinylcafe.com.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.